Hi, this is Melissa Wood Tepperberg, and this is the Move with Heart podcast. Are you ready?
Just breathe it all in.
I want to talk. I can't lie.
I was like, it's going to be short, sweet, and very spicy.
And we're going to get right into it because apparently some of you think I talk too much.
The information we are all about to receive on this episode with Dr. Ellen Vora is, for me, felt very life-changing, even just sitting here with her and listening to how she breaks everything down when it comes to depression and anxiety. And when I think of Ellen, I think of this path she's created of possibilities and opening all of her eyes to the realm of possibilities. When you start very small, and her approach is just, it feels doable, which is what I love so much about her. Dr. Ellen Vora is a holistic psychiatrist, acupuncturist, and a yoga teacher. And she takes a functional medicine approach to mental health, which is why I just feel so incredibly drawn to her. There is just something about the way she simplifies everything and helps you to really understand, especially your anxiety. She dives in to her two-prong approach, whether you have false anxiety or true anxiety. And I have to tell you, wow, it's so eye-opening and also just makes me like take a deep breath for all of us walking around, for those of us who run more on the anxious side. What makes her so special, and I'm just going to say one last thing, is how she connects science and spirituality. It just lands, and I really hope it lands for so many of you. I would definitely get a notebook, a pen, or take notes in your phone because this is a powerful one.
Dignified spine, and just start to arrive here. And just setting an intention for today. We call on help from guides and spirits. We call on help from source. And we just allow ourselves to be channels so that whatever is in service of everyone's highest and greatest is able to come through. In gratitude.
So beautiful. I love to start really my day like that, but I was in the bathroom doing my little thing too, but I had a feeling you were going to guide us in something.
It's a required step before everything that I do.
I know. I think that's what instantly gravitated me towards you. And I remember it so vividly. I don't know if you do, if you recall, do you?
Tell me.
Okay. It was at a Mind Body Green dinner and you were speaking. And first of all, I was like, how do I not know this woman? Like everything you were saying, like your approach. And I remember like taking notes. And then I came up to you after because I was just so present and like sucked in to beliefs. And I think it was more just making it all feel possible and hopeful and light. Because talking about, I mean, well, first off, you have such an incredible approach to mental health and you are a holistic psychiatrist, you're a yoga teacher, and you're an acupuncturist. Like you have such a well-rounded way into this world. And I think your approach to everything with anxiety, I mean, something that I have personally, I'm very gentle with how I describe this now too. And I feel like you'll have a lot to say that. I no longer say I have anxiety because I feel like it starts to take over your identity.
Yeah.
I say, I'm feeling anxious today, or less of like, it's this thing that has become me. And your teachings and the way that you share has just, I feel like, opened my eyes and like welcomed me in to the approach of taking everything differently than a lot of us are told we have to.
It feels really urgent to me that we change the conversation about mental health and about anxiety, because there's so much suffering right now and we need a reframe. We've all come of age with this particular hypothesis around depression and anxiety. It's called the monoamine hypothesis or the serotonin hypothesis. It tells us that if we're depressed, if we're anxious, it's because we have low serotonin. It has us focused on our mental health from the neck up. And it tells us that it's a fixed trait or a destiny, that this is something about us and it will always be so. And that's actually myopic and inaccurate. And it's our least hopeful narrative about mental health. And the truth of the matter is that so many other things influence our mental health, not just our genes. Even if we're looking at our genes, it's more complicated than that because it's our epigenetic story. But beyond genes and brain chemistry, how we're sleeping, how we're feeding ourselves, the degree to which we have inflammatory molecules in our bloodstream, whether or not we're moving our bodies, those influence our mental health, but then also more psycho-spiritual factors. Do we have community in our lives? Do we wake up with a sense of meaning and purpose? Do we have ritual, pleasure, play? Do we feel like we're being of service in any way? These are very real determinants of our mental health, and there's something we can do about this. We're not stuck. It's not our destiny. So we've been taught mental health is a genetic chemical destiny. And actually, I think of it as one of three main things. It's either a communication, our mental health issues, they are symptoms communicating that something physically is out of balance, or it's telling us about unresolved trauma, or it's talking about a psycho-spiritual unmet need. And once we know what we're working with, what combination of those different things, we can start to take steps. And we can actually feel less anxious, less depressed. We can go through our lives with less suffering.
Ugh, the way you describe that it's not your destiny, I had this chill, but it did this tingly thing in my head. It was so weird. I've never felt what just happened to me when you said that, because I think so many of us walking around suffering feel like, well, this is it. And it does weigh on your energy and the way that you carry the load throughout the day. I mean, I can tell you, since I remember, since a little girl at like 5 years old, I felt anxious and it carried and it built and it built and it built and it built until adulthood when I exploded. And I feel like the way that you lay it out, it just, oh, it opens everything. It's a heart opener.
That tingling sensation, I mean, that's basically what my second book is about. And to me, that's the stuff that we want to pay attention to. Because I really believe on some level, this is a magical universe. And how do we hear communications from realms beyond? And I think it's those tingles. I think it's a feeling of salience. It's a feeling of everything recedes and you're in a moment where it feels like guidance, it feels comforting, it feels like love. And I think that we're very rushed and busy and the world is very noisy and it's really easy to miss those communications. But I'm really interested in encouraging people, and for whatever reason, I feel like saying, especially women, to honor those feelings. Because I think we have unique access to that kind of knowing and we need a homecoming to it. It was always there. It's familiar to all of us. But we live in this world that tells us to be rational, to be objective, is to be intelligent. If we want access into the boys' clubs of this world, we need to perform our yang, our masculinity, being data-driven. And there's so much value, right? So there's value to that. Of course, I'm not here to malign that at all. But the yin yang shows us that these two states have equal value and they exist in dynamic equilibrium. And we've just been out of balance. And I think it's up to us to bring us back into a yin balance where we start to value the yin, the rest, the surrender, the intuitive, the non-doing. And I think that that's ultimately a homecoming to what we've always known was true, but we've been silencing it. We considered it impermissible and we squashed it, and it's time to come back to it.
So you're writing your second book?
Yeah.
Your first book, The Anatomy of Anxiety, really breaks everything down. And I think for anyone out there who's listening who hasn't got their hands on your book yet, can you walk us through just like a 5-step approach to how you would recommend managing anxiety naturally?
Yeah. So the central thesis of the book is that we actually have two types of anxiety. What I call false anxiety, which now, like 2 years into a book tour, I realize is a triggering term, and it's not meant to invalidate the very real suffering. It speaks to the fact that false anxiety is avoidable anxiety. It's the anxiety that's based in the physical body. Something trips us into a stress response, and then we experience that stress response subjectively as anxiety, even panic. And it's actually caused by seemingly innocuous aspects of modern life. We had a bad night of sleep. We're having a blood sugar crash. We had an extra cold brew coffee. We're hungover. Something has tripped our nervous system into a state of stress, and then we subjectively experience that as anxiety. And it doesn't need to be happening. This is not some deep truth. This is not a whisper from our inner compass. This is just unnecessary suffering. And we would do well to identify the root cause of it, address it on that level of the physical body, and then eliminate all this unnecessary suffering. And we can talk about specific examples of what we can do. There is another kind of anxiety, and it's what I call true anxiety. This is purposeful anxiety. True anxiety is not what's wrong with us. It's actually what's right with us when we are able to viscerally connect to what's wrong around us. That can be in our personal lives, in our communities, can certainly be about the world at large. And this is not something to pathologize. This is actually a sign of health. It has to do with when our inner compass is nudging us and telling us, slow down, get still, and pay attention because something's not right here. There's a call to action baked into our true anxiety. We need to listen for where do we need to course correct? Where do we need to show up? Where can we get something back into alignment? And once we get good at listening to our true anxiety, we're not so mired in anxiety. We're not trapped in it. We let that energy fuel purposeful action, and then we're mobilized. And importantly, the way I work with patients, we always start with the false anxiety. It's the low-hanging fruit. It's the quick wins, but also it's in the way. It's very hard to actually drop in and tune in to our true anxiety while our physiology is being pinballed all around. It muddies the air. It makes it hard to hear what's actually our true anxiety. So a typical patient might come to me and they might be having trouble staying asleep through the night. Then they hook up to caffeine and continue to consume different forms of caffeine through the day. They have intense cravings for sugary snacks in the afternoon. They're running around with that pit of their stomach, anxious feeling. Everything kind of feels like dread and overwhelm. And then in the evening, after they finally finish work, get children to sleep, log back on, finish a little bit more work, and then soothe their frazzled nerves with alcohol, with Netflix, with doom scrolling, and then rinse and repeat. And I think that we are living in a minefield of sources of false anxiety. So with someone like that, we might start really gently. Because usually if you're living like that, you've got no capacity for change. You're in survival mode. Everything already feels too hard. You're treading water. And so usually my first intervention is just go to sleep a little bit earlier. Don't do anything else. We don't need to overhaul your diet at this point. I don't need to come saying I'm going to take your coffee or your wine from you. It's just get into bed early. Start to wake up feeling more rested, more refreshed. I think even going to bed early is an underappreciated hack. because we can get overtired. This is something I learned when I had a kid, which is that, you know, kids, when they're tired, they're yawning, they're rubbing their eyes. It's so cute, but it's actually a low-key emergency because you're in a window, a sweet spot when that baby is perfectly tired and they will fall asleep. And if you miss that window, they become overtired.
All hell breaks loose.
They're arched their back. They're crying inconsolably. They don't sleep. You don't adult. It's not pretty. And what I come to appreciate, we adults are just oversized toddlers in so many ways. This is no exception. We also have a window or a sweet spot when we're perfectly tired in the evening. It's around 3 hours after sunset. And if we push past that, which many of us routinely do, then we also get overtired and suddenly we have cortisol in our bloodstream. We're hit with a second wind of energy. We feel vaguely warm. Suddenly we want to take on projects around the house. And even though 1 minute we were falling asleep on the couch, now when we finally do crawl into bed and try to fall asleep, we toss and turn and we can't sleep, which is so infuriating. We've been falling asleep ever since the minute we woke up that morning. And now when we're trying to finally sleep, we can't. And I think that for many of us, it's just that we got overtired. We missed that window. So if we start to look for our tired signs around 3 hours after sunset, when are we yawning? When are we rubbing our eyes? It's probably a good idea to drop what we're doing, change our diaper, get ourselves into our crib before it's too late.
I can feel everyone that's going to be listening to this be like, just you perk up. Like that was me last night. And then when you miss the window, it's like, I can take on the world. All creative juices are flowing. And then it's so much harder to wind your body down.
Yeah. And so that's a typical way that I would support someone. Once someone's starting to get in bed a little bit earlier, sleep through the night, wake up feeling rested, then we can do a lot more because then things feel within reach. We're not quite so overwhelmed. And we're all a little different. With anxiety, I usually like to start next with blood sugar because I think of especially panic attacks as a blood sugar issue until proven otherwise. And a lot of us are on this blood sugar roller coaster because the modern American diet is refined carbohydrates, coffee drinks that are secretly milkshakes and rosé all day. And so we're on this blood sugar roller coaster. When our blood sugar spikes, it's chased by insulin, causing it to crash. When it crashes, this generates a stress response in the body. And I don't make the rules. It's the design of the body. It's a decent design. It creates urgency for foraging for food. It cues the liver to break down the storage of starch that it keeps. It just happens to also feel identical to anxiety, panic, feeling overwhelmed. And so we can keep ourselves out of a lot of unnecessary anxiety just by keeping our blood sugar stable. Easier said than done. Sometimes there's motivation to overhaul our diets and eat in a way that's stabilizing for our blood sugar. More protein, more healthy fats, less refined carbohydrate, less added sugar, less alcohol. If that feels within reach, great. If that is overwhelming and making someone listening feel anxiety right now, okay. We always start exactly where you're at. And a lot of my patients, all they ever do is just incorporate a spoonful of something like almond butter or coconut oil to address their blood sugar. So what they do, because this is so fatty or proteinaceous and fatty, is that it's slow to be digested, slow to be released into the bloodstream. And so I'll have patients take a spoonful in anticipation of their typical crashes. So if there's someone who wakes up throughout the middle of the night, they take a spoonful before they brush their teeth at night. If they're on a mad dash for snacks at 3 p.m., you take a spoonful around 1:30. And if you pick a fight with your partner every day at 5:45 p.m. like clockwork, you could take a spoonful a couple hours before that, and this might help your relationship.
Wow. I'm so excited to try. I feel like before you leave, I need to take a hit of that and see what we have because I want to start testing that out. Mm. One shift that I've made recently in the past, I would say year, is I love coffee. I have this, it's truly tied back to this relationship and connection I built with my mom really young over coffee. So it just, it's symbolic and it makes me feel at home in this weird sense. But what I've discovered as I'm recognizing all of my false anxieties from your book is that most anxieties I was feeling was false. And waking up, having warm water and lemon, and I say avoid, I don't want to say I don't have, because sometimes on the weekend I do, but during the week I avoid going right for caffeine. And I try to have something. I find matcha doesn't do that to me. So that works well. But adding a little coconut milk, coconut oil is something I've been testing and playing around with too. But even if I'm like having that intense craving, I'll have berries, banana, and almond butter. And I find it doesn't pick me up and drop me.
Yeah.
A massive part of us feeling good truly comes down to ourselves. And this is something that I learned when I first entered the wellness space, working as a health coach at a functional medicine practice. Phosphatidylcholine is one supplement that I, first of all, knew nothing about until I started to really understand the importance of it. BodyBio PC has a pure liposomal complex that provides building blocks of your cell membranes. I know, stay with me. And this protects each of your 20 trillion cells. So aging and toxin exposure cause your cells to break down, and this helps rebuild and maintain their health from the gut membrane and everywhere in between. You can really feel the power of this. I swear, the mental clarity, smoother digestion, this helps better a detox and gives you more consistent energy. Equally as important, especially during these colder months, the liposomal vitamin C is clinically backed and effective. This company has done studies looking at the levels of vitamin C before and after taking this supplement. So you can see that their liposomal formula really, really works. If you are looking to give yourselves some love, highly recommend it. You can give your body what it needs by visiting bodybio.com and use code MWH for 15% off your first order.
I mean, that's the key to everything in life, is figuring out what things pick us up and don't drop us afterward. This is like how I discern all choices in life, because we're being sold around every corner things that pick us up and then drop us. It's a good business, because a lot of the smartest companies, they've figured out, how do we addict the human brain? And a big part of how you addict the human brain is you create a product that creates the need for itself. It puts you in a little bit of withdrawal, and then you're craving that product. So whether we're talking about caffeine or tobacco or alcohol or sugar or social media or video games, processed food, the list goes on and on. It ends up making us in this state where we are always somewhat unconsciously being driven by these withdrawals. And it's influencing our choices. It's even influencing what we consider to be dear to us. We defend these addictions, you know? And so with caffeine, I think it's really important to point out, I'm not here to say there's anything inherently wrong with caffeine. In fact, the medical research would say there's a lot of inherently good things about this. Coffee has magnesium and antioxidants. Tea has polyphenols. There's so much that's good. But we just have to work with our own unique physiology. There's a lot of bioindividuality with how we metabolize caffeine. And it's also influenced by, how are we doing elsewhere in our lives? Are our livers stagnant? Are we exhausted? All of this has an influence. I'm actually newly back to coffee after a really long respite from all caffeine. And I needed that respite, but now this has been delightful. And there's a sweet spot for most of us, which is that around 90 minutes after waking, that's where you ingest your caffeine, and more is not better.
So that's true.
That's a tricky thing. I mean, I think that that's what we do. We ruin everything by thinking a good thing, so more is better. Mm-hmm. And there's a sweet spot with caffeine. And I think that if you want your coffee, have your coffee, but just be strategic, aim for 90 minutes after waking. This way you get a little bit of a cortisol spike upon waking that gives you some lift, and then you're caffeinated through the day. But by the time you're coming down, it's the end of the workday. because a lot of us otherwise would come down around 3 p.m. and then we're tempted to reach for another coffee to get through the last few hours. So just shifting it slightly really serves us. And this way, it gives your body a better shot at being able to metabolize more of the caffeine before it's time to go to sleep. And caffeine has a long half-life. It's about 5 to 7 hours. So if you have one coffee at the beginning of the day, good chance that you'll be able to sleep fine at night. A coffee at 3 p.m, we should think of as effectively like having half of a coffee at 9 p.m. And we wouldn't do that if we struggled with sleep or depression or anxiety, but many of us inadvertently are doing that.
I mean, I was on a vicious cycle of that. And as I've been just heightening my self-awareness around everything, and I think just paying close attention to how I feel and function throughout the day, even just like taking notes, I have been doing this where I'll go into meeting, I write down how I felt, like if I felt like I needed to be in the meeting, like just really diving into my life and how I go about the day. I think so many of us are like, oh, it's Monday. And it's like, oh, Wednesday, hump day, the week. And I'm just like, I don't want to live like that. Like Monday through Friday, guys, it's a lot more time than the weekend. Like I want to feel invigorated, whether it's a Tuesday or a, you know, I'm like, how can I feel more alive with everything that I'm doing? Because I want to have other people understand that it's that feeling is possible when you start to dissect and pay attention. And I've been on this roller coaster with caffeine. It truly was my number one addiction because I really don't feel the same way about it that I used to, because there's been this, I don't want to say I've controlled it. I understand myself more. I know when I have heightened emotions or something coming up, the worst thing for me to do is have a coffee. Mm-hmm. No matter how much I love it and what it ties, it just doesn't sit well with me. So having a matcha and the waiting 90 minutes, first of all, when I first heard that, I was like, because, you know, I feel like it's been 6 months where I've been really trying to experiment with it. It's hard, especially as a, like, I wake up and I'm like, give me all the things. But waiting does make you feel the effects almost. I think you feel them even more, and then it's less of the need for it later.
Yeah.
That's the biggest. And why 90 minutes?
Yeah. So really just to time that curve of how our body metabolizes the half-life of caffeine. But I think also we can nudge toward that 90 minutes gradually, because a big part of why we feel that we need it sooner is that we are already in caffeine withdrawal sooner. Our body is really programmed by our behaviors. So if we're consuming caffeine the minute we wake up, then we'll wake up in caffeine withdrawal. So you can just gradually nudge it towards 90 minutes. You don't have to go cold turkey towards the 90 minutes.
That's what I did.
You brought up something so essential where you talked about you're noticing how do you feel in meetings, enhancing awareness at all times. And I think that this is critical for two main reasons. And one is that what are we doing here if not awareness? And I think even to use the mindfulness meditation concept of loving awareness, like this precious, wild, and often complex and fraught existence, if we're not in wide awake, loving awareness, we're missing it. And I think that part of what awareness allows us to do is we become aware of our stories. And once we're aware of our stories, we can do with it what we choose to do. And that story that we're also conditioned to have of, oh God, it's Monday, and ooh, it's hump day, and here's the weekend, and it's so brief, and all of this programming, it certainly makes us want to get through so much of our lives. And even just, I'm washing the dishes right now, we think, I want to get through this task so that I can get to that one sweet moment of leisure on the couch when I'm actually just going to look at my phone and be asleep in a different way. And I think that we want to be wide awake for the dishes, for even the suffering, and we can talk about that in a minute. But I think we also really want to be aware of our stories. I'm living this so vividly right now with working on my second book. And I came to realize I had a story that I am struggling with the book, that I kept using language like I'm wrestling with these ideas. And I was thinking all the imposter syndrome thoughts of I'm not good enough. I'm not a good enough writer. I'm not brilliant enough. Like all the things, like I look to other people that are aspirational. It's like, I'll never be that. And I was really losing connection with the fact that all I can possibly do is just bring forth the art that's alive in me. No more, no less. And I think that those stories were just blocking the ability to let that energy flow. And so I just, on a dime, switched up the story. I started to say to myself, writing is coming easily, that I'm asking for help from guides and they're showing up and they're helping me, that it's flowing. And it's pretty incredible. But this is what we're starting to play around with, is that not only do the stories we tell ourselves influence our unconscious, influence our reality, but also that maybe the energy in this universe is a little bit more malleable than we realize. And that when we change the story, everything follows suit.
Words are so powerful.
Yeah.
And even like paying attention to how you talk about yourself and you look in the mirror. I think all of those things, I mean, I remember during some of my darkest days, it was like I had such a wake me up moment once where I was just like picking myself apart. And I'm like, that's what I am carrying throughout the day. I think you have to first, like you said, become aware of what story is living in your head.
And I think like when we cannot stand in a place of self-acceptance, and I'll even raise the stakes, and self-love, really an appreciation of our own divinity, then and our worthiness of love, I think that it just keeps the existing power structures in place. Because the people, the humans that struggle with self-acceptance and self-love, it's every oppressed people. It's every version of whatever the world is trying to keep us down to keep who's in power. And I think it's a radical act of reclamation to realize I'm going to ignore all of that programming that's told me I should pick myself apart, that I shouldn't accept myself, that I'm not good enough. And I think from a place of reclamation, we step into so much love and appreciation for our magic. And it's so important to realize, I think we get humility wrong. Like we're always performing modesty. We're doing self-deprecating humor. We're saying like, oh, this old thing, and we're putting ourselves down. But then we sort of grapple with a kind of self-centered understanding of our specialness. And I think that we kind of want to cancel all that out and just recognize that I think we're all divine. I think we all are so inherently lovable. And there's humility in that awareness, because if we have something incredible to offer, it's coming from beyond the confines of our own ego. It's coming from beyond. Mm-hmm. And I think to allow ourselves to just realize we are here with a unique perspective, a unique set of gifts, and we're no better and no worse than anybody else. We're all just out here trying to do our reasonable best and allow ourselves to be loved.
It sounds so simple and so beautiful the way that you describe it. It's so touching, and I feel it because I'm like, it is so amazing what happens in your life when you really love and accept yourself and you move through the world with that confidence and just empathy and love and compassion towards yourself and towards the world. The world changes. My world has changed. Continues to keep changing because of like that simple act of really honing in on like the love I have for myself, the love I have for others, for the world. It's such an expander. I think for anyone who's listening who is not feeling that way and is feeling depressed, anxious, hopeless, probably doesn't have much of a routine or habits or rituals. Like, I love that you simplified it so tangibly where like sleep, I couldn't agree more, by the way. I always say sleep and avoid touching your phone before sleep. Like yeah. those two things, if you can just implement there, start there, really work on that. But for someone who really just feels this sense of like, where do I even start?
Yeah. Let me offer up two more of those yeah. false anxiety supports.
Okay, good.
And then I'm going to take us to kind of a deep and heady place.
Oh, I'm on a ride with you right now. So you just keep going.
So two other false things. I think that we do have to be making conscious self-loving choices around alcohol.
Thank you.
We're marketed to about alcohol. I love the book Quit Like a Woman by Holly Whitaker.
Great
I think
book.
We just need to recognize we're being marketed to. It's being shown to us as the empowering, boss babe, sexy choice. The cool choice. And the pearl that I think is most compelling for me to make different choices around alcohol has to do with our neurotransmitters. And we like alcohol partly because it rushes our brain with a particular neurotransmitter called GABA. GABA is like an unsung hero in terms of our brain function. It's the one neurotransmitter that makes us feel calm, like everything's going to be okay. And alcohol makes us feel that way. And so if the story stopped there, I would say alcohol is a great treatment for anxiety. But the story doesn't end there because our brain doesn't particularly concern itself with whether or not we feel calm or like everything is going to be okay. It's tasked with preserving our survival. And when it sees all that GABA, a homeostatic drive comes in, which is to say our brain thinks if a leopard were to come around the corner right now, we'd be too buzzed to care, and we could potentially be in danger. So it furiously attempts to correct this vulnerable situation by converting the GABA to a different neurotransmitter called glutamate. And glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. It's a completely different vibe than GABA. And I think this neurotransmitter conversion accounts for why, if we had a few drinks at dinner, many times we'll wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, heart racing, thoughts racing, and we'll proceed to toss and turn for the remainder of the night. And then the next day, our nerves are just a little more friable. We're a little more prone to anxiety, to darker thoughts, feeling of doom and gloom. It's a neurotransmitter effect. This doesn't mean we all necessarily need to forego alcohol altogether. We just want to let this information inform our choices. One night, it might be the worthwhile choice. The act of self-love might be to have the glass of wine. And another night, it might be that you think to yourself, I don't want to squander my sleep for tonight. I'm going to have a seltzer with lemon instead. And we just want to be making those choices through a lens of self-love. The other one has everything to do with the phone. And we could talk about just the phone alone for a full podcast. But the one intervention I think is most bang for the buck is to just not keep the phone on the bedside table at night. All we have to do is set up our charger somewhere else in our home, kiss our phone goodnight, like 9, 9:30, like, phone, I love you, I'm going to miss you. And then you enter your bedroom without your phone, read something life-affirming, and fall asleep. And that intervention alone protects us along a number of different dimensions. The blue light exposure from the phone, that's suppressing our melatonin and disrupting our circadian rhythm, so it's making it hard to sleep. But also the fact that we need to feel some semblance of safety in order to fall asleep. Such a vulnerable state. If you think about it on the proverbial savanna of evolution, where we could be surrounded by predators, we need to feel safe to fall asleep. And the algorithms of social media favor doom scrolling. And so we feel surrounded by every danger in every corner of the world at all times. And those are the posts that get the most traction. It steers our eyeballs toward that. But then we feel surrounded by danger and it's hard to fall asleep. And just keeping the phone somewhere else at night can make a big impact while we still live our lives and have phones and we haven't fully moved off the grid and raised chickens or made our own sauerkraut just yet. We're still living in this world.
And paying attention to who you're watching when you scroll. I think with the algorithm kind of sucking you in, I mean, we're all following or watching people we don't even know, and somehow we're all the way through it. Like, it just sucks you into such a deep hole.
Yeah.
I think really paying close attention, because I always like to see how I feel after, and I'm like, soul sucking. And it's like, limit the time, cut it a little shorter, and actually doing something for your life. Wow, you can do so many things.
this is what we were touching upon earlier, that we have to find the pastimes that lift us up, but don't drop us lower. And we're being sold around every corner the things that lift us up and drop us. The phone, social media, everything with screens, everything that with substances that lift us up and then create a hangover. And there are things we can do that make us feel good that don't drop us. We're just, no one's really selling them to us. They're somehow always the harder things to do. They're less seductive. And we're all a little different. One person, it's a good conversation. It can be dancing. It can be meditation or breath work or reading a paper book by candlelight while listening to calming music. It can be any time spent in nature, time spent with friends, with babies, with puppies. The one pastime that my partner and I have built into our life that is part of how we have something other than turning to screens to nourish us is we invested in a nice sound system. So listening to music is a very proactive, mindful act for us. We pull out the speakers, we kind of take turns choosing the song, and then it's, you're not looking at your phone while you're doing it. You're sitting there, we make it dark, we light a candle. It's a ritual. And then we just listen to music. And I think that that's healing, even on a vibrational level, but it's also this nourishing, rapturous experience that has no hangover.
Oh, I was there with you as you just painted that picture. That's, I'm trying that.
Yeah.
Because music does have the power to change your vibration. I think we all know that within seconds.
Yes. And to me, music is my religion. For me, there's something spiritual happening there. And that's how I tune into that.
So beautiful. I want to make sure, was there anything else you were going? Okay, you finish, because I'm going to dive into something I'm just enamored with in your life that we have to share.
We got to go there. So I was going to, I'll wrap up that last thread, which is the to take you somewhere deep, which I forget now what you said that brought me to this, but it's really around agency. And I think you mentioned, like, if anyone's listening right now and they're feeling depressed or they're feeling anxious, they're feeling hopeless. And first of all, just so much sympathy, right? And I really think a lot about how it's not necessarily sick or pathologic to be unwell in an unwell world. We are swimming in waters that are very conducive to us not being well. So we start with all the false anxiety, the false depression, address that. But then I think that a very hard to hear, but critical insight has to do with agency, that we actually need to be the authors of our own lives. And it's not to say we're not often stuck, oppressed, we've been victimized. This is all very valid and very real. And yet, it's a both and. That can be true. And generally, our path out is to take responsibility for our well-being, acknowledging that it can be so difficult and it can be differently difficult depending on your circumstance, but we still need to turn to this. And I think that when we feel that our unhappiness is somebody else's fault, it might be true, but it keeps us stuck. Mm-hmm. And we need to catch ourselves where we're externalizing blame, where we're in codependent relationships and thinking it's someone else's behavior that's causing our misery. And we need to say, you know, that might be true and their behavior is bad. This is all valid. But for me to be on a path towards feeling well, it actually requires self-agency, writing our own story and empowerment. And it's hard to hear that. It's hard to do that. But I feel like it's important to share that because it's sometimes the gate that we have to walk through to get better.
I'm so glad you went there because I think this is one thing I always feel like needs to be punched out a bit because I think people just aren't being honest with themselves and they're not taking ownership of their lives, actions. And just as you said, like in my life, there are a lot of things that weren't mine, but you know what? It's like, what am I going to do with it? Let it destroy everything within me, even the relationship, or take a different path.
Yeah, exactly.
When I think of you, I think of a different path. You've carved out a different path and you make that path feel so possible when you just are ready to get honest with yourself.
I feel like Different Path is at the center of how I want people to reconnect to hope when it comes to their mental health. Because I think of healing and mental health as this mountain, and we're currently being offered really just two paths up that mountain. It's medication and it's psychotherapy. And sometimes those are exactly the correct path for someone, and that's great. But I've been doing this too long to have a simplistic view of that. And oftentimes, it's an unsatisfactorily helpful path, and it doesn't get someone all the way there. And so that's where I think it's really been a crisis in my field. We've been doing the population a disservice saying those are the only two paths. Those were never the only two paths. And if those paths are not getting you all the way there, we need to take a different tack. And that's where if meds or therapy haven't gotten you to a place where you're truly thriving, then you want to look at, is it sleep? Is it inflammation? Is it hormones? Is it a micronutrient deficiency? Is your gut unhealthy? What's your relationship to caffeine, to alcohol, to sugar? Do you have unresolved trauma? Do you want to do a trauma-focused therapy like EMDR or somatic experiencing therapy? Do you have community? Do you have ritual, pleasure, play, a sense of meaning? Do you step back and seek and live the bigger questions? And if meds and therapy aren't getting you there, these are all paths that are available. And I just want someone to know they're never stuck.
Mm-hmm. So for someone who is doing all of those things to the best of their ability, or they believe that, and then do you feel taking that step of meds? I also, kind of two-part question, would love your approach into the world of psychedelic treatments. Mm-hmm. And I know for myself, like, it's something I'm so curious about. Yeah. Just from experiencing traumas, and I feel like getting myself to such a great place, but I'm like, but there's just a thing, there's something.
Yeah. So the first part I want to address is if someone's already doing all of those things, if someone's doing everything that I'm recommending, sometimes that's our problem. And so especially, I mean, we're in the wellness world and listeners are kind of doing all the things. And there's a point when self-care, wellness, dietary interventions, where it starts to get in the way. And we even create this sublimated eating disorder of orthorexia, an obsession with doing things the right way. Mm-hmm. And wellness was never the point. The point was always, can we lead our version of a fulfilling life? And sometimes when we're unwell, our physical health is in the way of our ability to live a fulfilling life. And then sometimes when we are too deep in the weeds of the wellness practices, that has become what's getting in the way of our fulfilling life.
I am so obsessed with these bars. If there's one thing I do not leave home without in my bag, it is an Elemental Superfood Bar. These seed bars are made with no seed oils, no additives, no preservatives, and no artificial ingredients. They taste so good. They are not chalky like a lot of bars are. I've always had a really hard time with bars, but these bars not only taste good, they are high in fiber, a good source and balance of protein and carbs. So they are not only good, they are the perfect functional food to reach for if you're in between a meal or if you're traveling. These are my absolute go-to. And you can choose from 6 classic seed bar flavors, 2 adaptogen seed bar flavors, and 4 crumble flavors. You can visit their website at elementalsuperfood.com for a special offer for 15% off your order using code MWH15. I think in this wild, dynamic world of wellness that I'm love and obsessed with, sometimes it can all just be too much and you just have to like just go for a walk or just like tune out of all the things. And I love all the things. Like, I know the things that I love and the things that have really added to my life and helped me when I'm in a place of feeling like I need true guidance and assistance. But there is so much power in also peeling back the layers and lessening the load.
I'll add a false mood I almost never talk about. It's not in the book, but I think it's relevant right in this moment, which is that sometimes the source of our anxiety is actually that we're too thin.
Mm. You talked about this. I want to talk about that.
Yeah. It's to be a little bit underweight. And what's tricky about this is that the world positively reinforces it.
Mm-hmm.
They say, you look great. You feel great. Yeah. Your clothes fit well. Everything's working, except mm-hmm. that you have this churning sense of anxiety at all times. You get a little bit lightheaded sometimes in a yoga class. And so I think that sometimes what serves our body best, what keeps our physiology stable and feeling like it has enough and where we're just juicy and good and have stable energy, stable mood, it doesn't look like what we think is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the problem there is our conditioning and the cultural pressures on what a body should look like. And the golden compass is to listen to your body.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows what any given body is supposed to look like. We know what our cultural idea of like the current ideal of beauty is, but it's a listening dialogue with your own body. What's enough? When does your body say, this feels good?
Mm-hmm.
And when does your body say, I know this might look good through that lens of our cultural ideas, but if it feels like it requires active management and you're always uneasy, that's probably not where your body wants to be.
I can say personally through my own experience, through times when I have been my thinnest, I've had peak anxiety.
Yeah.
I think what I've discovered through really finding my happy weight with self and like no longer trying to fit into a size or weigh myself, like it's so liberating.
Yeah.
To get rid of a scale. And like, I literally have no idea how much I weigh because I'm like, I don't need to focus on that. And I don't need to check that number every day. And finding a place that like just feels really good. And I feel like good in my body. For some people have called out like, well, you're too thin, you're too this. And I'm like, maybe that could be perceived that way. But knowing the changes my body has gone through the years of yo-yoing, I'm like, I'm at a really comfortable place with myself, you know, and knowing that because I can feel it in the balance. You feel when you're imbalanced. Well, some of us.
This conversation also begs the sort of acknowledging the both and of when we emerge from an orthorexic, anxiety-inducing state of too much restriction, a lot of us are tempted to run the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of running right into the treat yourself arms of the processed food industry that, by the way, engineers food to be hyperpalatable, i.e. it's basically drugs. And so then what happens is we start feeding ourselves from a place of, we're refugees from restriction and from wellness, but it's also not an act of self-love. We start to feed ourselves like a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to land in a middle zone where we are choosing how to feed ourselves, not from a place of restriction so that we look a certain way, but in terms of what does our body need? What feels good? What feels nourishing? What's pleasurable? What's easy? Mm-hmm. What's affordable? What's convenient? But it's always with a light grip and through that lens of, I am choosing to eat this because I love myself. And that can look like any kind of food as mm-hmm. long as it solves that question. Am I eating this because I love myself?
I love that so much. It made me think of, after all the years of like not really having pizza and having vegan pizza, every gluten-free pizza, this, and now just like getting to this place where I'm like, one thing that I've been doing with the kids every week is like we order pizza and I like, I have a slice because I love myself. Like I don't care. Like I'm like, this is so delicious. Like I'm just so happy to have this. And I don't think like this is a reward. You deserve it. I'm just like, I love myself. Like I can have a slice of pizza and not feel bad about it. It's liberating.
Yes. So, okay. I think that that's all the threads. Wait, there's also a psychedelic thread.
I mean, I just am enjoying this conversation so much. I hope everyone else is. I can feel, I love when I feel this way when I sit here because it's just like why I love doing this so much and bringing people on like yourself to just like crack us open. And look at things differently. Look at ourselves. Like, look at the way we're living our life. One thing I am just enamored with and jealous with the way you live your life When you first told me, I think we were at Spring Cafe. Mm-hmm. I think when you started talking about like your living situation, and please share, because I was like, do you live in a commune? Like, it just sounds like something I really want to experiment with.
Yeah. So let's say the framing here is that we just need to be intentional about how we design our lives, with the awareness that the default setting in modern life, it's not conducive of mental health, of ease, of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. It's really tough out there. And so one thing that we do very intentionally, and to the tune of, there's a lot of proactive decision-making, a lot of coordination, there's a lot that goes into this, but we live in what we sort of jokingly refer to as a commune. It's not really a commune. It's just my family of three and another family of three living about a 15-minute walk from each other, but we do life together. We do meals together. We co-work during the day. We pick up our kids from school together. We travel together. We basically just expanded the love, and we have community, and we are going through the trials and tribulations of parenthood together. We're bearing witness to each other's experience, and it just is so nourishing. It's the best part of my day. And so I think that it's not so out of reach. This can look a lot of different ways, but you want to think about, what is a family? What is a group of people out there that you're compatible enough mm-hmm. with? And then you start to orient life around this. And even if it's just like the most basic thing that we do every day is, after we drop our kids at school, we take a walk. It takes a half an hour. It's a half an hour I'm not working. The type A person in me is kind of like, oh, I can't do that. But now I realize I can't not do this. And it's also my circadian walk. I take my glasses off. I take in the sun. It sets the clock so that I can feel awake during the day and get tired at night. But also it starts the day where I drop in and I connect with someone I really love, and we process what's going on in our lives, and we set the intention for the day. And it just is more important than anything else. We need that community. We are humans. We are social creatures. This is in our hardwiring. On that proverbial savanna, we were not the fastest species. We were not the strongest species. We were the ones that figured out about cooperation. And I think it's for that reason that when we feel held by community and a sense of belonging, we feel safe. We feel like we are okay. And when we feel isolated, disconnected, ostracized, on some level to our DNA, it feels like it's a matter of life or death. And so I think it's worth a lot of proactive coordination and even sacrifice to start to design our lives around community, because it's not going to happen in the default setting.
I wonder how Noah's going to feel when I ask if our friends can move in. Like, we all have those friends when you're just like in the kitchen, like cooking, and there's music, and you're just like, I love doing life with you. I always say, like, a few of my girlfriends, I'm like, I could have a wife too. Like, you could move in. Like, this works. Like, we do this really well, and I like it, and it's fun. And then it's like, Noah comes, you know, it's just like, ever since you shared this with me, I've just been so intrigued.
And a lot of the most oppressive and toxic emotional labor of parenthood, dare I say motherhood, it's the relentless need to be choosing what we're going to eat for dinner and acquiring that from the grocery store and chopping onions and all of that. And to do that alone while also overwhelmed and drowning with everything else going on in life, it's too much. It's too hard. So in this commune that we're in, that's a shared task, which not only decreases the burden, but it actually makes it fun. And so it changes it from being something that drags on our spirit to this joyous thing that we do together. And I think it's really critical that our kids witness this as well. We both have only children, so that they kind of have this pseudo sibling, and they see their parents having relationships. They see their parents getting their needs met. They don't see us in constant sacrifice and burnout and feeling depleted and feeling resentful, because that's quite a heavy burden to put on a kid. And they see this full, rich life. And I think that that's medicine.
Sign me up. I'm seriously like not kidding. Like, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to really start paying attention to who's the lucky one. Noah stays homely and stuff. So like I need a little bit more company.
I should mention, I can't believe I didn't add this detail. One very critical thing that we do in our commune is my commune wife and I do Melissa Wood Health together every day. Of course we do.
Oh,
this is like a built-in part of our day. In the middle of the workday, we co-work and then we pause and we do MWH, and we joke about the fact that you're yelling at us sometimes because we're talking in the back of the class.
That's so, I love that so much. I mean, when people tell me that they take the class, they're like, we go on at the same time, we're FaceTiming and like we work out together, yeah, like all over the world. I'm like, that is so special. And also has me like, how can we do this together? Of course, always thinking,
yeah,
but it really is like community gives you life.
Yeah.
And it does. It gives you purpose. I know for me, I feel this contentment that I've just never really experienced before because of something that I've put my heart and soul into. That's not, and not that being a wife or being a mother isn't enough, but for me, like I needed something that I had built and created, and it's powerful.
To me, this is about the fact that as humans, we are social creatures. We are also artists. This is what we do. We create. And I think that it's my worldview that there is some force, something vastly beyond our comprehension. I think of it as source. And it wants to birth things, mm-hmm, through us, through humans. And when we are lucky enough to hear that call, to feel like we've been assigned some mission, and it's always voluntary, by the way, you can say yes or no. But when it's been offered to you to get to birth something, to make something manifest, I think it satisfies a very essential need that we have as creators, as artists. And so, yeah, I don't think I would be satisfied without letting everything that comes through, I need to figure out ways to become a portal for it so it can come through, so that we can carry out our little contribution.
I'm so inspired by you. And every time I see you, even at drop-off or at a dinner, like I'm just, you make my nervous system feel really calm and easeful. And the way that you articulate things is so, like, I get it. And sometimes it can be really confusing when you hear people talk and I'm like, what? Like, but it just all makes so much beautiful sense. And I'm just so excited. I'm excited for your next book and to keep seeing all the incredible things that you're doing. And I do want to say too, I saw a retreat. I don't know. I was like, I don't know what it is, but that was a vision that came up for me when you were talking. And I was like, I felt this synergy of something.
We're announcing now.
We're going to Bali.
That's where it all got started.
I'm telling you, that was like something that came up for me. So,
I'm in for that. I feel the need to close the psychedelic thread.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I mean,
oh,
yeah, it's barely been opened, but it was sort of
Then I want that personally. So give it to me.
So the way I think about the psychedelic conversation is that I'm a psychiatrist. I feel that my field is in crisis. We do not have treatments that work for enough of the population. And I want to acknowledge there are people that are helped by the current offerings in psychiatry, and that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I'm not against that. I'm a psychiatrist. I prescribe these medications. I've seen them do miraculous things. Mm-hmm. I've also seen people for whom they were initially effective and then the effect wanes, or they can't tolerate them for some side effects or adverse effects, or for whatever reason, it's not the right path up that healing mountain for someone. So we need other offerings so that we're not leaving people high and dry. And I think psychedelics are one of our most promising new lines of ways to support mental health. And some of the ways that they work rhyme with what we're already doing. They're active on 5-HT2A serotonergic receptors in the brain. They're sometimes anti-inflammatory. They quiet the default mode network, which is really interesting. It's a lot like meditation. Where do we step out of future tripping or dwelling on the past? Where can we actually arrive into the present moment, available for loving awareness of what actually is, and perhaps dissolving that limitation of what we consider to be the limits of ourself, that maybe we're more interconnected than we might realize. They also promote BDNF, or brain drive neurotrophic factor, which in English means we can grow, we can change, we can have neuroplasticity and neurogenesis. We can carve new grooves, new paths in our brain, and it doesn't have to be that we're stuck in entrenched patterns. So all of that is the kind of like, it's what we've been doing, slightly enhanced, maybe sometimes more effective. But I think that the aspect of psychedelics that has me most hopeful is something called the mystical experience hypothesis. And it's the one that shows us that the degree to which somebody has a mystical experience, a peak life experience of awe in a psychedelic ceremony, that correlates with the antidepressant effect. It correlates with how enduring that effect is. So that is not like what we're currently doing in the field of psychiatry. That is fundamentally different. And it speaks to the fact that this is not just operating on a biological level. This is creating an experience of awe that shifts our outlook and in a direction toward connection, feeling that we are loved, that we can trust, that we can surrender, toward a state of awe and knowing that we are the source of love in this universe. And I think that that's an exciting new treatment for psychiatry.
I'm so excited to learn more.
And I'll add, there are caveats. It's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's truly, I don't just say that medical legally and cautiously. Mm-hmm. I do not think that these are right for all kinds of brains. I think a brain that already has a lot of chaos, you don't want to introduce a new agent of chaos. You actually want to look to where we can stabilize. But for many people, what's happening there is we're almost too rigid, too concretized and stuck in our entrenched behaviors and patterns. And that's where shaking up the snow globe can be really transformative.
I could talk to you all day. I could just keep chipping away. Thank you so much for everything that you do. It's changing the world. Like, we need this. It excites me so much to have people like you pioneering paths that we all need to know are possible. I keep saying the word possible, but that's what you have helped me personally experience, is this realm of possibility. And I hope so many people listening are walking away feeling the same way as I feel very confidently that they're going to.
Melissa, thank you for doing what you do. And I think whenever it was that you started meditating and cultivating this ability to be a portal and a channel, and you're making this manifest on the world, you're a powerful light worker. I'm honored to be on this journey with you.
Thank you. That means so much to me. And just tell everyone where they can find you, your website, your handle, your book. I've said The Anatomy of Anxiety. Give us everything.
I'm most active on Instagram. I'm at Ellen Vora MD. And then my website's ellenvora.com. And my book is The Anatomy of Anxiety.
And are you open to seeing more clients?
I'm not taking new patients.
I figure that would be a big question. So I wanted to make sure.
I feel like I need to make this approach accessible, like, to anyone who needs a different approach to mental health. So I've decided that writing books is probably the best way to put it out there for all to have access to.
Great. And before we finish, I would love to hear what it means to you to move with your heart.
We come by it honestly that we're also stuck in our heads, right? Because all of the positive reinforcement through our education system, throughout our complicated logistical lives, there's a lot that's telling us move from your head. And I'm someone who really liked moving from my head. It got me places in life. But I've come to appreciate that if we're going to do anything of import and shift the balance of what we're actually poised on this cantilever is between fear and love. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we want to make our contribution to shifting us from fear into love, it's only coming from here. This is not where it's at. And so we drop in. It can be as simple as just bringing our attention to our heart and taking a few slow, deep breaths. Mm-hmm. But this is where we want to move from.
It changes everything.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Loved our conversation.
Me too.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. We have a special offer for our Move with Heart listeners. When you join MWH as a new member, you will receive an entire month, that's 30 days for free. And this is in addition to our 7-day free trial. All you have to do is head to melissawoodhelp.com and use code MOVEWITHHEART. At MWH, we believe this practice is not just about building this body you desire. This work is about building a better, stronger relationship with yourself. And that is why we offer everything from movement, meditation, and nutrition to help you not only look, but most importantly, feel your best. Follow me on Instagram at Melissa Wood Tepperberg and MWH at Melissa Wood Health. Tune in for an all-new episode next week, and I cannot wait to see you all on the mat.